The House Committee on Revenue for June 21st, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have some time limits on some of the people that we're dealing with today, so we're going to open the work session on House Bill 2087. Is that one yours? Yeah. Tell us a little about that. And Department, I think you're up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2087 would expand the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. The Dash 5 Amendment replaces the measure. It expands the Bill of Rights to include information about the procedures used by the DOR for the collection of tax debt and the procedures by which a taxpayer may appeal decisions related to collections. It prohibits the department from contacting the taxpayer by phone if a valid power of attorney has been filed and the department has been notified of this power of attorney. It requires the department to cancel any unpaid tax over 20 years old and any associated penalties and interest. It provides for an exemption from this requirement for the taxes associated with the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program and the deferral for local improvement districts. It requires the department to publish standards used by the department in determining whether an agreement to satisfy tax liability through installment payments facilitates collection of the liability. And it requires the department to consider the collection standards of the Internal Revenue Service when developing these standards. The measure is found to have a minimal revenue impact, mainly due to canceling any of those unpaid taxes over 20 years old, and also found to have a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and while this bill is not our concept, we are not opposed to the provisions that are in it. They're all provisions that we can administer, and many of them we are planning on doing anyway, so we're happy to work with you on that.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Colleagues, you'll recall that we heard this bill on April 3rd, so it's been a while. And it was brought to us by Kent Anderson from Eugene, who is an attorney who works, among other things, in the area of I guess we could say delinquent taxes, and had a proposal. This, I think it's fair to characterize this as a narrowed down version of what he originally proposed, but which contains a number of elements that he asked for.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. There were a number of concerns he had from our conversation that related to the cost of some of his proposals, whether the revenue impact or fiscal impact, and he did agree to scale those back to where everything would be minimal.
Great. Do we have the paperwork?
Yes.
We do. All right. Good. Colleagues, what's your pleasure? Representative Smith-Warner?
Mr. Chair, I move. Oh, sorry. I move the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2087.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner removes the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2087. Discussion? No discussion. Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Smith-Warner?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2087 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves House Bill 2087 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection to the motion? Hearing none. It is so ordered. I think I'd better carry this one. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2087. Colleagues, I want to open a work session on House Bill 3388. Whose is that? That's Kyle. While Kyle is coming, this is I don't think this is a bill that we've heard, but it is a bill that the Committee on Ways and Means is in need of for their own purposes. And I've agreed, assuming, of course, that the committee agrees, to send it to them without recommendation.
Which one is this?
3388, and I think the valuable part of the bill, as I understand it, is the relating clause. So maybe we should start with that. What is the relating clause?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's relating to public health.
Relating to public health. You can see why Ways and Means might want that bill. Representative Smith-Warner, I'd appreciate a motion to send it to Ways and Means without recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3388 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves House Bill 3388 to the floor without recommendation and with a subsequent referral by prior reference to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Representative Johnston, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think I'll be opposed to the motion. I guess I'm just getting a little weary of some of the relating clauses that are moving around without public hearings to justify their need on the other end, so I'll be opposed.
Thank you. I think the subject that they're interested in the other committee is not related to what's actually in the bill, and so a public hearing probably would not be a useful exercise anyway at this point. They will, of course, have to hold a public hearing in order to move the bill. Any other discussion? We better call the roll. The question is on the movement of 3388 to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation.
Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative Hernandez.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Marsh.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner.
Aye.
Chair Bornhardt.
Aye. Thank you. And with that, the motion carries, and the bill goes to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3388. And all right. I'm going to have to stand at ease just for a moment so I can figure out what I'm doing next.
Good idea.
We are not doing a public hearing today on House Bill 3469. That's right, Paul, isn't it? Yes, we're not doing a public hearing on 3469 today. It's not ready. We may reserve that for a later public hearing. We will be holding a public hearings on House Bill 2061 and House Bill 2060. And I can open those together, can't I? At this point, I think I will do that. So we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2061 and House Bill 2060. I'm not sure who's got those. And colleagues, for 2061. The point of opening this bill today is for consideration of the amendments that were posted earlier. The -2, -3, and -4 amendments were shown all on slightly different, significantly different topics. You want to give us a quick rundown of these amendments, and then we'll hold our public hearing.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2061 has three amendments for consideration. The -2 would replace, they all replace the measure. The -2 replaces the measure and reduces business expense deductions by 2.5% for C corporations with sales over $25 million. It takes effect for tax year starting after 1/1/2018. The -3 amendment also replaces the measure, and it creates additional requirements for partnerships and S corporations to qualify for lower rates on pass-through income. It changes the employee requirement from 1 employee to 10 and require that they work a certain number of hours per year. Also requires that the business be in one of the certain list of NAICS codes in one of those sectors, so the sectors are listed there. And it would take effect for the tax year starting after 1/1/2017. The -4 also replaces the measure, and it removes the deduction for corporate and personal income tax for employee compensation in any amount exceeding $1 million, and it takes effect for tax years starting after 1/1/2018. In OLIS, there is a summary sheet. It's kind of in the all caps meeting material. It says options for 2061, and it kind of goes through those three three options there, and you can see the various revenue impacts for those amounts.
All right, and then the other amendment that we're looking at is on the other bill, 2060, and that is similar to one of the amendments on 2061, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the 2060-1 amendment is the same as the 2061-3 amendment. And so both of the measures were up for a hearing for purposes, I guess, related to the relating clauses, and but it's identical to the dash three.
Thank you. Wonderful. So we get the let's say revenue officer.
Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, let's say revenue office. You actually get all three of us because we each worked on different amendments. I worked on the business deductions one. Chris, of course, has been working on the limiting the pass through that amendment, and Christine has done the work around the deductibility for highly paid employees. So, and as Christine pointed out, you can see the estimated impact for those provisions. The common element particularly for the two and three that are listed there is that they in effect limit deductions that can be used at the business level, which has the effect of increasing net income subject to tax. So, but we would be happy to answer any questions about those. Should we do a brief description?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll start out with the amendment around limiting business deductions for large C corporations. There's been a fair amount of discussion in the literature over the years about the distinction between this is actually the dash two amendment. Distinction between profits that are what are called book profits that are reported at a public level versus profits that are reported at the tax level. And of course, those two have two very different roles. But what we have done is tried to estimate that overall difference. And there's been quite a bit of empirical work on this. What's the difference between profits reported, book profits versus taxable profits? And what we've seen is a difference of about, on average, about 34%. In other words, if you take your current, these are done with federal estimates, if you take federal taxes and to raise the same amount of revenue to apply the current federal tax rates to book profits, which would be higher than taxable profits, you would raise about 34.9% more revenue. So in other words, and what we tried to do was take Oregon's margin, which would be net income divided by sales apportioned back to Oregon, and then apply that factor. So we would assume that our 6 and 7/6 rates applied to that larger book profits would generate about 34% more in revenue, and that's the basis for those revenue impact estimates. We've applied it as the amendment limits this adjustment to corporate taxpayers with sales in excess of 25 million Oregon sales. So it's limited to the larger corporations with greater than 25 million.
Okay. So now does that limitation on the larger corporations improve the accuracy of the estimate, or is it for some other reason?
Mr. Chair, the reason, I don't think it's necessarily accuracy, it's to reflect perhaps another measure of income or ability to pay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's using the book profits. I think the argument or the basis behind that is the book profits are a better representation, perhaps a more accurate representation of ability to pay. So you make that adjustment, and then you would apply the same rates to that larger base. Mm-hmm. And the way it would work in terms of at the state level, you would still base it on the federal return. So you'd have the federal return, you'd have overall receipts at the water's edge for the federal return, and then you would take those deductions that are against the federal return, you reduce them by 2.5%. That would increase the amount of net income, and then you'd use the Oregon sales factor apportionment formula to apportion that back to Oregon. So in other words, you'd have a bigger net income number to apportion back to Oregon.
Okay. I think that if I understand the theory of this, the business expense for tax purposes as defined by the Internal Revenue Code is a result of actions by Congress to establish what those are. and therefore it's ultimately, at least in part, a political document.
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair, I know this committee has talked a lot about a depreciation and how you treat capital, and there's, and you know, one of the goals in taxation around depreciation is oftentimes, particularly at the federal level, to try to encourage investment. So it's not really necessarily an accurate reflection of the physical rate of depreciation or even the economic rate of depreciation. It's more a policy tool. Right. And that, of course, is a major factor that goes into determining net income in any given year for right. tax purposes.
And, of course, other transactions that are primarily entered into for tax purposes would certainly be reflected in expenses for the purpose of taxation, but not for the purpose of accurately reflecting the state of the business to shareholders or the SEC.
Yes.
Is that an accurate statement?
I think so, Mr. Chair. I would say definitely that the if you think about the roles of those two measures, the incentives are really the opposite. I mean, to present your book profits, you want to show that relative to your shareholders what your profitability is, where with your taxable profits, you obviously have an incentive to minimize them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you see that gap between the two, along with these timing patterns, which I think is very important to
Thank you. And, of course, the organizations that establish the way in which profits are reported for the shareholders and for government regulators attempt to get as close as possible to an accurate statement of the company's actual financial situation at the time the report is for. Isn't that right?
Well, they definitely follow a set of guidelines that they're required to follow for that purpose, yes.
Well, and the guidelines are established with the intent in mind of making them as accurate as possible.
That's
Isn't
correct.
That true?
Yes.
Yeah. So if the question was, do we want to use the federal definition of business expense or the definition of business expense used for these other purposes, and we were interested in accuracy, we would be more likely to use the latter rather than the former, wouldn't we?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that would certainly give you probably a closer reflection of what the true economic status is away from the policy aspects of it. What you've proposed here in this amendment, however, is a change, is going back to the federal basis.
Right.
And then make an adjustment based on that to reflect an estimate of what that difference is. And the reason for doing that, rather than, say, trying to rely upon some other data source, for tax purposes, would be administrative. So,
well, there's a couple of other reasons too. Some of these very large businesses don't actually file public information.
That's true. Yes.
Because they're closely held businesses.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And where did the number 97.5% come from? Can you tell us a little more about that?
It's a rough approximation of the 1.349 I mentioned before, which is the difference between what a given set of tax rates at the national level would yield for taxable income versus book income.
Okay.
So it yield about 34.9% more, and that's what I use for the basis to get to these estimates.
Thank you. So that all of these numbers are estimates.
Yes.
But the 97.5% is likely to be more accurate estimate of the real condition of the business than the current system that we use.
You're using it as a proxy to try to estimate that.
Right.
And it would certainly be you're moving away from some of the policy factors that you mentioned earlier about the federal taxable base.
Right. Now, among those issues, I assume, are the various things that take place that are used by businesses to avoid or evade taxation based on transactions entered into primarily or solely for tax purposes. And the one I'm thinking about specifically is my bugaboo, which we've referred to as the tax haven law.
Yes.
This helps to compensate for that particular kind of movement of funds designed solely for the purpose of evading taxes in the United States, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, I haven't done the detail on the breakdown, but certainly in the articles that are the basis for this, that is really one of the primary focuses of the reason for it, is the income reporting method that you've discussed in this committee quite a bit.
Right.
And where you're not subject to federal taxable profits until they're repatriated back to the U.S.
Right. And
so that's a big part of this difference, yes.
And the book method ignores all of that, doesn't it?
Well, the book method is that it kind of ignores the geography.
Yes. Right.
That probably is the biggest factor.
Right. Other questions for Paul on this topic? Representative Johnson?
It's a question, I guess, for Paul, but I guess perhaps for you too. And I guess I'm wondering, as we look at all three of these amendments, are we trying to fix a problem? Or have we been in kind of the revenue reform discussion here mm-hmm. as of late? Or is this just simply looking for revenue at any source that we can glean it from? Because it seems to me the discussion has pivoted over the last day
right.
or two.
I think that's a question for me. And I think the answer is that we're trying to get a tax system which is most useful for the purpose of accurately reflecting the reality of the in this case of the business entity, so that our taxes are based on actual reality rather than something else. Now, we haven't gotten to the other two topics yet, but let's hold off on the other two-thirds of your question until then, if that's okay.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's go on to the other two topics.
Well, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2060-1 and House Bill 2061-3 contain modifications to the policy regarding the pass-through entity rate structure.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been discussed on the Senate side and in some context in the Tax Reform Committee. So what each of those, they're identical amendments, and they make two policy changes. One is it restricts the eligibility to participate in the pass-through entity policy to seven economic sectors, and it also limits it to entities that have 10 employees or more. And in OLIS, we've gotten a couple questions around this, and in OLIS, under House Bill 2060, there are three handouts, three documents related to this that I wasn't going to go through, but in expectation of questions, there's information that I had provided to the committees over the past 6 months or so. One of them is a PowerPoint from last December, and then other two are related to preliminary information from the initial tax returns. And the way it scales down the policy, the reduction, the focus on the industrial sectors takes the revenue impact and it reduces that to about 25% of the initial impact. By focusing it on those sectors, it reduces the impact by about 75%, so it's 25% of the total. And then limiting it to businesses with at least 10 employees reduces it another estimated 30%.
Okay.
So that reduction overall reduces the new projected cost of the program would be about 20% of the current law impact. So that reduction of 80% is the revenue gain that is reflected in the revenue impact statements.
Okay, but now the point of the establishment of this idea in 2013 was to, as I understand it, was to promote export industries. Isn't that what the argument was at that time, as I recall?
Right. The focus of the policy was to provide an incentive to reduce taxes for businesses competing in export markets to give them additional revenue to invest in their business. It even started before that with access to capital.
Right.
So it was invested in it was a focus in traded sector to try and increase employment and help the competitive nature of businesses.
But there were no sideboards on which kinds of businesses could participate in this particular incentive program. Was there in 2013?
There were many discussed, but none were implemented.
None were implemented.
I mean, you have some hours in there, so this creates some of those sideboards.
Okay. So My argument in favor of this kind of change is that it correctly points to what it was that the legislature in 2013 was trying to get at, which was support for export businesses and help them to generate capital so they could grow, and not to include other kinds of businesses that basically service industries and other things that don't have those attributes. This change actually tends to promote that focus, doesn't it, as compared to the bill that was actually passed in 2013?
Correct in that. That was the direction for how we got to the economic sectors that are listed in the amendments.
Right. And so the economic sectors and the amendments are ones that are much more likely to be involved in export businesses.
Right. With the best examples, you have agriculture and then manufacturing are the two primary ones.
Right. And they're the biggest ones. As you do your analysis,
right,
they're the largest sectors that will benefit from this newly sideboarded rule.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions for Chris on this topic? Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So Chris, where did the 10 persons factor come into play? What's the logic or rationale behind that in order to qualify for the deduction?
Chair Barnhart, Rep. Johnson, the discussion there started with creating jobs and trying to increase employment, and there were a lot of administrative difficulties with measuring increased employment and exactly what that would be. So I think the 10, there's nothing magical about 10 versus, say, 9 or 11, per se, but the intent there was to focus on employment growth in these sectors and to get at those kinds of companies.
I think it also has to do, doesn't it, with companies that size or larger are more likely to be able to utilize the additional capital in ways that increase the business.
Correct.
Companies that don't need that many employees probably also don't need the capital because they're more likely to be in the warehousing business, brokerage business, or other kinds of transfer businesses rather than in the businesses that lead directly to the production of products for export.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add, please, just on a process thing that we actually, we introduced a bill with the same relating clause as 2060 in the Senate, Senate Revenue, and this language really comes from the work that the Senate Revenue Committee did.
Yes.
And it's had a series of hearings and discussions around the topic. So this is just lifted from that work the Senate Committee
did. This was the -2, essentially the -2 from Senate Bill 164.
Yes.
Right, and they did have a number of hearings on that issue, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Item number 3.
Mr. Chair, the third item is to disallow deductibility for employee compensation over the amount of $1 million. I used some information from the Oregon Employment Department about how many employees have compensation above that amount. 100% of them end up being in the private sector. That's not surprising, but then it's a little bit more rare to find that type of compensation anywhere but the private sector. The definition of compensation here includes wages, salaries, bonuses, commissions, stock options, or any other form of remuneration paid to or accrued by an individual in return for personal services. And so it simply limits the deductibility of that amount. I figured the amount over $1 million and applied the tax rates to it and came up with a revenue estimate of $209 million for a full biennium, around $200 million. And so adding back that amount would result in that much additional revenue.
All right, thank you. Now, my understanding is that the Internal Revenue Code already includes a limitation on salary deductibility above $1 million. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I think I would have to look into that. The deductibility would be for just the salary amount, and this would be for
exactly
compensation.
Well, that was going to be my point, was yes, that this amendment adds not, it doesn't apply just to salaries, yes, but also to any other form of compensation, including bonuses, deferred compensation, and a whole variety of other things. Is that be an accurate statement? So if you were a business and you were trying to avoid the issue in terms of the Internal Revenue Code provision, you would simply not provide compensation above $1 million in wages. You would apply it to these other things, deferred compensation, bonuses, and so forth. And the object of this bill is to make sure that, at least for Oregon tax purposes, the actual intent of the law would be put into effect, because it would cover all compensation. Is that an accurate statement?
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on that as well, because I think that I'm intrigued. But what I like about this is we talk in this committee a lot about how we can establish state regulations that, when we see problems going on at the federal level, there are times that we can deal with that. And the idea that at the federal level it's limited to salaries, you cannot deduct anything that's in salary above $1 million, and so there's been this switch to having non-salary compensation. And so I think the fact that this says establishes compensation, which was the intent of the federal legislation, but certainly is not how it's playing out, I think that's I think that makes a lot of sense as a way for us to go here.
Thank you. From my point of view, the value of this kind of a law would be that it tends to put more emphasis then on the actual distribution of wealth and income generated by businesses. I think it's something that we're very aware of in Oregon, is that the generation of wealth continues at a great rate. Very nearly all of it now passes to people in the top 10%, maybe 5%, 20% of the income distribution. And the great wealth generation of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which allowed pretty much everyone to get an increase in income and wealth, seems to have stalled a long time ago. Limiting compensation at the top end may actually lead to an improvement in other sectors, which is, of course, a major policy, I think, of our efforts in a whole bunch of places, trying to make life better for people in the other 80% of the income range. Other questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I think the topic of total compensation as it pertains to employees is an interesting one, and would be a useful one for us to have in the public sector as well.
Yep.
To talk about salary, step increases, healthcare costs, and so forth. It's a very interesting topic, and if we're going to discuss it in the private sector, it might be interesting to bring that to bear in the public sector as well.
Thank you. I think that's a great suggestion. Of course, it applies to the school boards and other organizations as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Okay, let's go on with our public hearing then. It looks to me like we have the same people on both bills. Anthony Smith, Jenny Dressler, Roger Beyer, please.
I'll go ahead.
Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony K. Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We represent about 7,000 small businesses here in Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses, and just here today to express our opposition to actually the base bill 2060, but also its -1 amendment and then the -3s to 2061. You'll see a couple of documents that I loaded to OLIS ahead of this hearing, and one of those documents has to do with a survey that we conducted back in February when this issue was before the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, as Mr. Halanek referred to, and we were interested in how our members were using the pass-through entity tax rates, and so we got that data back from that survey, and we found that about 28% of our respondents reported using the small business pass-through rates in tax year 2015, which was the very first year that it was available. You'll recall it was part of the 2013 special session grand bargain negotiation, but it didn't actually take effect until tax year 2015. And so back in February, we wanted to find out, you know, in advance of our members filing their 2016 taxes, did they use it in 2015, and were they planning to use it for tax year 2016? We found that 28% used it in that first year. And remember, it's only a certain pass-through entities can take advantage of that. So it wasn't a big shock to us that 28% used it in the first year. But only 20% of those were aware of the rate structure before they filed their 2015 taxes. That told us that their CPAs were the ones that told them about it. Now, this all changes when we ask them if they were planning to use it for the year 2016. And 42% of our respondents said they were planning to use it in the second year that it was available. So based on a conversation that they had with their CPA and knowledge of the availability of the tax rate and how to use it, how to go about qualifying it for it, how you need to restructure yourself in ownership or the number of employees or the number of hours that those employees worked, as our members became more aware of those requirements, they were happy to take advantage of that in the way that the state has set out those requirements. So specifically to 2060, the underlying bill, and I'll just be brief on that since it seems like the dash ones are of more interest to the committee, but requiring a year-over-year increase in FTEs is problematic, especially for the smallest of small businesses. If you have one employee today, it would be 100% workforce increase to get that second employee, and then year after year, you know, by year five, you have to have five employees, by year 10 employees. So it would be very problematic and difficult to continue to use that tax rate in subsequent tax years. Now, specifically to the dash ones and the dash threes for 2061, I wanted just to mention, you'll see the other document on OLIS that says oppose the dash three amendments to 2061. There's a list down at the bottom, the top half of the document kind of goes through the history of the grand bargain and how the pass-through entity rates were a part of that discussion. But down toward the bottom, you'll see a list of industry sectors in green, and you'll see a list of industry sectors in red. And the green industry sectors are the ones that are these traded sector industries that are included in the dash threes of 2061 and the dash ones of 2060. So those would be the ones that would get to keep the pass-through entity rates. All of the other codes on the right-hand column in red would be the codes that would are if they're qualifying, if they're industries that are qualifying to use the pass-through entity rates today, they would no longer be able to use those rates. So like an average small business member in construction, for example, if they're paying 7% today, they would be paying 9% if this were to move forward. So, and I wanted to just highlight a couple of, because these industry codes really don't tell you the whole story of what types of businesses are included in. Some of it is very obvious, but others are maybe not so obvious. And so I just wanted to kind of expand on who these small businesses are. There's home builders, electricians, plumbers, heating contractors, excavators, and pavers. Those are all included in construction. And, you know, there's other conversations in the building happening right now around affordable housing and transportation infrastructure and the needs of the state for those things. So, you know, how much bridge can you get for your dollar when you're making an investment in state infrastructure? You know, all of those factors increase costs on small businesses. Retail trade also excluded in the dash threes and the dash ones. Auto stores, furniture stores, flooring, household appliances, computer, hardware, lumber, glass, garden centers, nurseries, bookstores. Then there's the finance sector or property management sector, and that's a very small percentage of our membership, but it's actually major line items in most of the monthly expenses of virtually every Oregonian. So that one's one that we're taking a look at and we're concerned about. Based on the LRO documents numbers that I believe Chris put up, that kind of goes through how much each sector costs in terms of the tax expenditure and how that's scored, Professional scientific and technical services are by far the sector that has benefited the most from these rates. I think it's about 28% of the overall expenditure score is attributed to this one sector.
I'm sorry, which sector was that?
The professional scientific technical services. But those include far more than just lawyers and CPAs. They include architecture firms, engineering firms, landscaping services, environmental consultants, and oddly enough, your veterinarian for your dog. You know, these are great paying jobs and exactly the kind of jobs we would like to see more of, regardless of whether they're traded sector or not. And when entrepreneurs are looking for the right location to start up and grow, you know, the tax code does matter. So I just wanted to kind of illuminate maybe some of those industry sectors who are, so to speak, on the chopping block, and just oppose you to or urge you to oppose these Dash 3 amendments and the Dash 1s to 2060.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are the state's largest general ag association, representing about 7,000 production family farms and ranches, production scale. We are here today to oppose the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2060 and the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2061 for many of the same reasons that Mr. Smith outlined. I think I wanted to characterize a little bit of our industry and some of the comments that were made. I think many of you have heard my testimony before, and you know that 80% of the commodities that we produce in Oregon leave the state. Of that 80%, 40% leave the country and go somewhere else and enter that global market. These operations, and you've heard this as well from me, operate on extremely thin margins. Our farms are very thin margin operations, and they did benefit from those lower personal income tax rates that were passed in 2013. The criteria that are in both of the Dash 1 and the Dash 3 amendments are going to significantly restrict the availability of those credit or of those rates for our members. Growth looks different in agriculture, and lately it's taken the form of automation due to labor shortages and to increased workforce costs. You'll see, and the dairy industry has been adopting robotic milkers, robotic feeders. In the blueberry industry, you see mechanized picking. And then I even met somebody recently who is working with drone technology to reseed forests. So really interesting developments in technology and those developments are helping to grow these businesses, but not necessarily adding full-time equivalent positions. And just given the nature of agriculture, they can't add full-time equivalent positions. It's too expensive. I wanted to speak to the seasonality of our operations as well. As you're aware, agriculture is very commonly seasonal in nature, perhaps not the dairy industry, but other sectors are most commonly seasonal. And the proposed requirement for a business to have 10 employees each pay period will disqualify the majority of our sector, the family farmers and ranchers, from qualifying for the credit. So the provisions within the amendments would actually disqualify our members from taking that small business tax cut. If that doesn't disqualify them, with the 10 employee requirement, then the requirement that each of those 10 employees work for 1,200 hours a year will disqualify them, again, because of the seasonality of our industry. Mm-hmm. So these amendments, as we see them, disadvantage our smallest operations, and they also seem contradictory because there is an interest in promoting those natural resources, manufacturing sectors, at least as far as we see in the amendments, and the criteria that are imposed are gonna disqualify the majority of our membership from being able to take that. I mean, as a final point, and you've also heard me testify to this, but we are concerned about retroactively applying those rate increases to the 2017 tax year. So folks have already made decisions. We're halfway through 2017. Our small businesses have already made decisions based on the assumption that they'd be able to take those lower personal income tax rates in 2017. And changing that halfway through the year is going to change the viability of their businesses. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here today representing the Western Equipment Dealers Association. The Western Equipment Dealers Association is an international trade association that represents approximately 2,200 farm, industrial, and outdoor power equipments across the country. In Oregon, they represent 64 locations. These locations account for over $450 million in revenue and nearly 900 employees. And you might think, well, those aren't small businesses, but these businesses depend on the farm economy to survive. And you've just heard from the Ms. Dressler about the impact on the farm economy, and my association has the exact same concerns, because if farmers have no ability to buy equipment, my members have no ability to sell equipment. So for that reason, we are opposed to the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments and the base bill in 2060. We just think that this is the wrong time. Farm commodity prices have been on the downturn lately. Costs are rising. So we've already got a struggling farm economy. Our members are struggling to sell equipment into that economy, and raising taxes on those folks will make it that much worse and thus affect our businesses. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. And I'd also like to just point out that I think you have a letter from Ms. Dressler and the Oregon Seed Council, who I also represent, is also a signer on that letter in opposition to the same amendments. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Anthony, could you take us back to the grand bargain and back in 2013 and the rationale between the different components, because there's actually a small, there was actually a tax increase in
Correct.
Addition to a tax decrease. But could you talk about some of the, from your recollection at least, what the rationale was and why the legislature enacted this?
Correct. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. I actually was not here during those negotiations, but I've done a lot of research on it since then. And what I found was quite interesting, because as you'll see on the document that has those lists in green and red, is that the net effect of the 2013 House Bill 3601 was actually a $180 million increase in revenue, because part of the package was that the corporate tax rates were increased from the 6.6 to the 7.6% for the income between $1 million and $10 million. Before that, it was the higher rate was only applied to the $10 million or more. Then now there was a couple of other aspects to the entire grand bargain, and specific to House Bill 3601 of the 2013 special session that I am not an expert in. One relating to medical device. Something to that effect, but yes, it was the part of the negotiation was to come up with additional revenue, and part of that, some of the offsets for that additional revenue was the small business tax rates.
Correct. Please go ahead.
And I guess just to follow up, then since that time, there's been some angst related to certain occupations that might be taking advantage of this that perhaps aren't related to ag or manufacturing or industry and so forth, and the suits and scrubs, as we've heard them referred to. If you were going to enact something to modify it in a way to alleviate some of that, what might you do that could be different than what's being proposed here?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I maybe that proposal would not necessarily come from me, but there are ways that you can drill down in the NAICS codes. The NAICS codes are actually like a five-digit number, not a two-digit number. The two-digit number just gives the industry sector. If you drill down into the expansion of those numbers, you can actually get down to like a veterinarian within the professional services, and I have nothing against veterinarians; they're great people. But you can actually get down to certain professions or more specific industries if you would desire to do so.
Just a final comment, I guess, Mr. Chair. It is interesting as we talk about modifying one of these last remaining vestiges of the grand bargain that we're talking about modifying, the one that provided some tax relief rather than the one that actually raised taxes as well. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you. Question for Anthony. You said in 2015, the first year, 28% of your members took the, and I'm sure you've had a chance to study the data that was compiled by staff in terms of income levels in 2015 of those filers who used the pass-through. And you'll note out of 13,000 claimants that a disproportionate number, more than half, were in income levels from $200,000 to above $500,000. Another large chunk was $200,000 down to $100,000. So about 11,600 out of 13,300 were, would you do agree, high income, very successful small businesses, if that represents a significant portion of your membership.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, I'm actually looking at that report right here in front of me, too, and I would not dispute LRO's data in any way. What I would probably say is that if you were to enact the dash threes of 2061, requiring these certain industries, and especially that 10-employee threshold limit, that the smallest of the small businesses that are included in the zero to 50,000, 50 to 70,000, 70,000 to a 100,000, and any of the folks in that 100 to 200,000 that might be, you know, closer to the 100 end scale, would be eliminated by these dash threes. I think that the dash threes really do advantage larger businesses to the smallest of the small businesses by having that 10 employee threshold requirement. So I think this would look worse, actually, in the future.
That's good.
Anything else? You indicated that you expect a larger percentage of your members to take advantage of this program in the future. Any sense as to what that is?
Representative Chair Barnhart, when we did our survey back in February, 42% of our members who took the survey said that they were planning to use it for tax year 2016. Now, they were just at that point preparing to file their 2016 returns. Mm-hmm. And so that was a noticeable increase over the first year that it was available. But like I said, not surprising in the first year that something was available that not everybody knew about it or took advantage about it. And part of the one of the intricacies of the way that the statute is written is that it's an irrevocable election. So you actually can't go back. If they were to have found out after the fact from their CPA or someone else that they had not taken advantage of this in 2015, they couldn't do an amended return to take advantage of that. So they had to wait until 2016 in order to take advantage of that. In fact, Senate Bill 164 was the base bill was to address that. We would still support that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Jody Weiser, please.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. So we weren't available to work on the amendments after they were posted, so my comments are directed to the bill itself. But we do think it's a perfect opportunity to look at better public policy. Under current law, the profits of a corporation are taxed twice, while the profits of a closely held business are taxed once. And the pass-through entity is only aimed at at the closely held entities rather than at the corporations that the owners basically pay taxes twice on. So that might be a consideration. If you're looking to generate a certain kind of activity, the type entity that the business has chosen shouldn't be the relative issue. There are many technology firms that start out as C Corps because they know they're going to have to get money from investors because they don't have enough of their own, and they're going to be research-based. They need equipment and stuff, and they usually are C Corps because that's what investors ask for. So you might look at what that rather than just the closely held entities part. This product is a General Mills product. The taxes on it that Oregon received could be as high as 17.5% because the corporation could pay 7.6% and the shareholders could pay 9.9% when they pay taxes on their dividends. This product is a Portland company that is privately held. So their taxes would be someplace between 7 and 9.9%. So maybe 9.9 and maybe 17.5. That's really a significant difference that public policy should probably look at. But for your constituents, whether they're grocer, their hardware store owner, their construction contractor, their housekeeping service, or their lawyer, has their business organized as a C corp or an S corp, or as a sole proprietor, is a matter of indifference. That's really an issue that affects the owner, not your constituents who purchase their products or services. We've heard that the rationale for passing the pass-through rate, we've heard it expressed in two different ways. One is growing jobs, and one is bringing capital to businesses. And without clarity about what the purpose it is, it's hard to get to the correct policy. So I think that's important. But we do have many programs that are there to support businesses of any size, whether they're startup or mature. For instance, we have NAMI and Otrati, we have the Food Innovation Center, and we provide trade mission support, and we provide loans to businesses through Business Oregon. This seems the most direct approach to providing the services that business owners need. Seems like a tax break is an odd way to go about it. But if we are going to use the tax code, then maybe we need to look at really carefully how to direct those reduced rates. For instance, changing from one employee, which is somebody that's just barely starting and isn't necessarily a good risk, to a company that had three employees might make sense. And then stopping when a company gets to 25 employees, because they actually are having success if they've gotten revenue either from selling their goods or services or from investors, then you could reduce that benefit or end the benefit at 25 employees. We think the trade sector idea is a good idea. And we think that you could probably reduce the profit level from $5 million to $3 million. It's all a matter of just picking a number out of the sky. But in my experience as a private equity investor, it's usually years of no profits before you get to profits, and that's part of why it's hard to use a tax break as a way to support a startup business. So it seems like it's a hard tool to use to start to help startups, and the kinds of things we have, like the Food Innovation Center, where this business went for help, is the better way to help them. And the Credit Enhancement Fund that you funded last year with enough money for $30 million in loans would be another place to expend the money that might be more fruitful. I think I've said everything else that I have here to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have questions?
Questions for Jody Weiser, please. Thank you so much. We very much appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2060 and House Bill 2061 and open a work session on House Bill 2060. And we've already had the hearing, and I think we're ready. Representative Smith Warner, the Dash One.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash One Amendment to House Bill 2060.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves the Dash One Amendment to House Bill 2060. Discussion? Objections to the motion? There are, so we better take the roll.
Representative Bueller?
No.
Representative Fernandez?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith Warner, to the floor, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2060 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves House Bill 2060 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection to the motion? There is objection. Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Bueller?
No.
Representative Fernandez?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor. I will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2060. Thank you, colleagues. We have I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3206 for the purpose of explaining the amendment, but we're not ready to work it yet. But I'd like the committee to know what the proposed amendment is on this bill, and with the hopes that we may be able to actually work it tomorrow. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Did I open it? 3206?
Yeah.
I need to open it. All right, we'll open the work session on House Bill 3206. Now, Chris, tell us what the amendment does.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the drafted bill contains six different policies related to tax credits, and the amendment limits those policies. So it basically strips out five of them and leaves in the 12% credit for expenses for an employee training program, a qualified training program in a qualified county. So basically the way the language reads, I'm trying to pull it up here. It defines a qualifying county. So basically we're talking about Klamath County, and it has certain metrics related to unemployment rate compared to the unemployment rate for the state, and refers, and another qualifying piece is an armed forces installation of the armed forces in the United States that employs so many civilians. All of those basically boil it down to Klamath County.
Oh, he's here. Yeah, go ahead. Keep talking, and the sponsor of the bill is going to come and tell us some more about it.
So it boils it down to Klamath County and creates an employer tax credit of 12% of the costs of employee training programs. And you do have a revenue impact in there, but that's basically the credit. It has a three-year carry forward, and it is non-refundable.
Thank you. And did you indicate the revenue impact?
The revenue impact I put on there is basically minimal. I found some information on average cost of employee training programs. I didn't have any specific data on the 12 employee training programs in the county, but the details are spelled out in the revenue impact statement, but the cost for these employee training programs are on average about $1,300. And so I scaled that to $100 employees. So we're talking about $130,000 per 100 employees. The 12% credit then is about $15,000. So the revenue loss is about $15,000 per 100 qualifying employees. Klamath County has private sector employment of about 17,000. So assuming that 2% of the entire private sector workforce are employees in these training programs, you get to about 300 to 350 employees in any year that would be in one of these training programs, and that's about a $50,000 revenue loss per year. So that's how I arrived at that figure.
Thank you. Representative Rushkie, thank you for coming back. We saw you here earlier, and then you left, and I wasn't sure you were coming today. So,
well, thank you, Chair Barnhart, and esteemed committee members. Thanks for having me back again. For the record, my name is E. Werner Rashke. I am the state representative from House District 56, which encompasses southern Klamath and southern Lake counties. We guard the California border. So I'm here testifying again on House Bill 3206. I know there's a dash one amendment, and after we testified the first time to this committee with Commissioner Minty Morris, who I'm real proud of all her work on this bill and her effort of her team to get it to this point. We received great feedback on the concept. I think it was Rep. Smith who had mentioned that this doesn't cost the state anything unless these activities take place. So if these activities don't take place, then the state doesn't lose out. We're not setting aside money for something that doesn't happen. With that, I also understand where we're at in the session. And you have a larger task than I do here at in with all of revenue. So I know the Dash 1 amendment basically deals specifically with the portion of the bill, Section 3, which is training at coordination with the local community college, which is great. Yes. And we think that's a small step for the large goal of Klamath County, and we are in favor of any help we can get at this point, even though we'd like all of it. We're favorable on the Dash 1 amendment, and what we'd like to do is to show you what we can do with that and then come back in the 2019 session and see if we can work on the other sections of the bill again. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Well, and I'd encourage you to come back in 18.
Okay.
On the other sections.
I plan to be here on both, but yes.
Right. Thank you. Let me ask, you have a co-sponsor on the bill. Is
yes.
your co-sponsor okay with this amendment?
Yes, he is.
All right. Questions for Representative Reschke? Yes, Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Reschke. Of course, we actually want this to be used. We don't want it just to be put
right.
on the plate. So my question to you is, do you know of employers in Klamath County for whom this, specifically for whom this will be the right incentive?
Chair Barnhart and Representative March, the initial impetus was to use the uniqueness of Klamath County having a military base and also a four-year school and also a community college within 10 miles of one another mm-hmm. to try to lure in some cybersecurity companies. Mm-hmm. And so that was the main goal of this, all those sections was to try to capture the interest of cybersecurity companies, especially not just for national security, but in the case of a Cascadia event or something like that, Klamath is on the, we'll call it the right side of the Cascades for that as the staging area for supplies and so forth. And if that Cascadia event were to happen with some sort of cyber attack, because we were vulnerable or weak, it would be a good place to be able to do that. We also have solar, we have geothermal, so there's a lot of aspects of Klamath County that make it an ideal place for cybersecurity companies to headquarter and start building their software just because of all those reasons.
Cool.
So.
You have a unique mix of government facilities, businesses, educational facilities, all in the same area, don't you?
Correct. Chair Barnhart, correct. Yes.
Yes. Other questions for the representative? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Now, I think I'm going to withdraw what I said earlier. I think the bill is ready to move. Representative Smith Warner, would you move the Dash 1?
Could we stand at ease?
Yes, the committee will stand at ease. Please don't wander off. Committee will come back to order. Disappeared.
Took a call.
Oh, okay. All right.
Like a motion?
Yes, please. Representative Smith.
Do you have any
the Dash 1, please.
Falls to you. Just keeps coming down.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to 3206.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3206. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing, we're voting on the Dash 1.
Good thing I got back.
Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. We're on a roll. Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3206 as amended, I guess, to the floor.
Yes, please.
To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 3206 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Representative Reschke, will you carry the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd be proud to.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we'll be back.
Yes,
thanks.
Sir.
All right.
Yeah, and we look forward to hearing how things went with this piece.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3206. Committee, I think we've completed our business for the day. Do expect to be ready at a moment's notice for our next meeting. I don't know when that will be, but stay tuned. With that, the committee's adjourned.